Welcome back. You know, there's good 80s and there's bad 80s. This is good 80s. Bonnie Tyler, Nothing But a Heartache. Seems she and Rod Stewart have that same kind of sandpaper quality going on with their voices. Love it. Love it. A new study is muddying the Tunguska mystery. Newly published research by Russian geologists raises new questions about the infamous Tunguska blast and seems to upend one long-standing theory about the mysterious event. It had been long suspected that Lake Chico, or Lake Cheko, rather, in Siberia, was the impact site for the incoming meteorite that scientists believe caused the enormous explosion that rocked the region way back in 1908. However, a study on the sediment found at the bottom of the lake reveals that the site is nearly 300 years old and therefore could not have been created by the Tunguska event. And you can read more where Sean Latisore has posted this story in the In the News section at coasttocoastam.com. Hey, you can listen to my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show, Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. Zoomer Radio, incidentally, has the largest broadcast footprint in North America. So at night, it can be heard from northern Ontario into parts of Quebec and from Maine to Minnesota and all the way south to the Carolinas. Zoomer Radio, AM 740. For more information on my radio program, visit strangeplanet.ca or download my free app, The Conspiracy Show. Strangeplanet.ca, again, is the website. Back to more of my conversation and your questions and comments for Marcus Allen as we discuss the lunar landing hoax right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. Marcus Allen stays with us, as well as your comments and questions coming up. Let me just share one on Twitter, Marcus. Adam writes, or tweets rather, "I doubt the cameras used by the astronauts were off-the-shelf cameras." Good point. Was it possible that the Hasselblad camera they were using was quite different than those commercially available?
Right. They were changed slightly. They were built to the specification as required by NASA. I mentioned that the viewfinder had been removed, which is the mirror. That was removed. And they were painted with an aluminium-colored outside. All of the leather linings and coverings that are on standard Hasselblad were removed as well, because in a vacuum space, obviously, they wouldn't work. There were various other modifications. One of them, the major modifications, was the insertion in the camera body between the body, i.e. between the lens and the film, of a screen containing 25 crosshairs, or reticules, as they're technical now. This was in order that every photograph taken with a lunar Hasselblad would show these 25 crosshairs. And you can see them on all the images. I mean, there's no secret about it. Why they were put there, of course, is a debatable question. We're told it was all in order to measure distances on the lunar surface, which seemed a very odd way of doing it. A more conspiratorial view would be to say that in order to line up the various images that were required to be created in order to show the lunar surface. So you have these crosshairs. So, yes, there were various modifications done on the camera, but it was basically a standard Hasselblad body, standard Hasselblad magazine, which contained the larger magazine could contain about 200 black and white images on a roll of film. It's the same film, in effect, that was used on the IMAX cameras today. They've got sprockets on the side, which is how the film is advanced.
Right.
It's a sort of gear mechanism to advance the film.
Well, yeah, gear, sprockets. This is a mechanical device, and we have extreme temperature differences on the moon, whether you're in the shade where it could be 100 below, or if you're out of the shade, it could be 100 to 180 degrees. Has this been tested, how a Hasselblad, a mechanical camera, would operate, if it would operate, under those extreme temperatures? I mean, I take my smartphone out in the cold weather, and it'll turn off even if it's fully charged.
Exactly. This is one of those anomalies about the whole lunar photographic record. How did the camera operate under those conditions? You're quite right to say that the temperatures on the lunar surface are extreme. I mean, that's not in dispute at all. 250 degrees Fahrenheit in the sun, minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit, or thereabouts, in the shade, because there's no atmosphere on the moon. It's a vacuum of space. The heat is not retained, as it is here on Earth, by the 60-mile-high atmosphere that we have here. The heat is not retained. Therefore, if you move from sunlight into shadow, you move from 100 degrees plus centigrade to minus 100 degrees centigrade. And again, this has been demonstrated on the space shuttle. When the first space shuttles were being used, they orbit the Earth, so they spend half their time in the sunlight and half the time in the shadow. And when the astronauts on the space shuttle were operating outside in space in their spacesuits, they were building things and putting satellites into orbit and repairing the place. And they would complain when the orbit took them into the shadow of the Earth. They would complain and say, look, my fingers are getting so cold, I can't work. Can you do something about it? And NASA apparently said, oh, don't be so stupid, of course it doesn't go that cold. So they said, well, let's take a thermometer up there, we'll show you, which they did. And they demonstrated that, and the report actually says in exactly these words, within a few minutes, when entering the Earth's shadow, the temperature dropped to minus 100 degrees centigrade. So after that, I said, okay, well, let's put electric heaters into the gloves so your fingers don't get so cold. So it's quite evident that the amount of heat in space is dependent on the amount of sunlight. And the amount of heat is quite excessive when in direct sunlight. And when not in sunlight, the amount of cold is life-threatening. It is so cold. It's much colder than any place here on Earth. The coldest place here on Earth is in Siberia, where it goes to minus 62 degrees centigrade. Antarctica is very similar. Well, you've got these extreme temperatures. Humans can't survive under those conditions. We freeze up. And so do cameras. Cameras
makes sense.
Freeze up because
it makes sense.
Lubricating oil inside them. Now, in a vacuum, that lubricating oil will boil away. So in order to keep the mechanism working, they have to have either Teflon coating on any moving part, or the thing will just seize solid. So the answer to the question, did they adapt the camera? Did they change the camera? Yes, they did change them slightly. But the basic camera was the same camera that you go into a shop today and buy. There were alterations made, but they weren't excessive alterations. They were just practical alterations.
All right, let's go to the wild card line. Woody is in Whittall, Pennsylvania. Woody, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Good morning, Richard and Marcus. My question is a little off. I'm more perplexed by a video. I'm not sure which mission it was, but when the module took off, the camera panned up as it took off and followed it. Now, how could that be? I'm thinking it couldn't have happened by remote control because of the time delay, and then they would have had to have a series of servo motors and other things that would have added weight to the payload. So that was something that always baffled me.
Great question, Woody. Well, what say you, Marcus?
Yep. Right. It's a question which has arisen many times. It's actually a very good question because it's so obvious when you look at it's the Apollo 17 lunar takeoff that we see, because the previous ones were filmed, Apollo 15 and Apollo 16. They were filmed using the television camera that was mounted on the lunar rover. Now, we all know that light travels pretty fast. 186,000 miles per second, but the moon is 240,000 miles away. So the light from the moon takes 1.3 seconds to reach Earth from the moon. Radio waves travel at the same speed as light. The answer to the question, because NASA has been asked this question as well, is that they had to practice. It was the camera was operated from Houston by a technician who had practiced many times. If you do the calculation, you've got to start the camera panning. You've got to press the button in Houston to start the camera panning upwards 1.3 seconds before it actually will start to move. And then you've got another 1.3 seconds before you can actually see the picture coming back again. On Apollo 15 and Apollo 16, they didn't get it right, so they couldn't pan it upwards. On Apollo 17, they appear to get it correct because you follow the lunar module as it takes off, the ascent section of the lunar module, and you see it panning up into the sky, and you follow it up, and it goes up for about 15, 20 seconds. There was a technician, we're told, who practiced doing this quite frequently. So he was timing his button-pushing movement to the astronauts' statement that they were taking off. They did a countdown to firing the rocket, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire the rocket. So he had to press the button 1.3 seconds before they said fire.
Sure, well, that's plausible. That's plausible.
But we also have another problem here, is that in order for the camera on the lunar rover to work, it needs energy. Those motors, the motors which direct the camera's position, have to have power, and that power was supplied by batteries. The batteries were sitting in the lunar rover in direct sunlight. How did they know there was enough energy in order to operate those cameras? Because it would take quite a bit. I mean, if you look at the camera, it's not a particularly big camera, but any servo motor that would operate would still require a degree of energy. How did they know there was enough energy remaining in the batteries, which had been operating now for 3 days on the lunar surface? And they didn't have spares. They didn't have alternators to recharge the batteries. It's one of those unanswered questions.
Indeed. To the wild card line again, Joey is in San Diego. Good morning, Joey.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just have one question. I'm wondering about when the astronauts walked on the moon, you saw a bounce that they bounced up in the air, and I wondered how they I don't believe they went to the moon. I wonder how they got that bounce when they walked. And I'll take your answer up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joey. All right, Marcus, how did they simulate, assuming this was a hoax, how did they simulate the fact that there is less gravity on the moon?
Okay. The technical term is overcranking, which is a term used in the film business, whereby if you shoot a film at a faster rate than you're going to project it at, it will appear to slow the movement down. If you do an analysis of virtually all the lunar films taken of astronauts moving around on the lunar surface, they all appear to move in a very strange way, in a sort of slow motion, as you described it, bouncing way. If you start analyzing the film, it looks as if the film is being transmitted at a slower speed than it was shot at, which is a standard way of producing slow motion images. In the James Bond film, Diamonds Are Forever, we get James Bond, our hero, diving through the apparent lunar set where the astronauts are moving slowly, very slowly. Now, quite why it is necessary to show slow movement, it's because a lot of the training was done underwater, where you do move quite slowly because you've got an enormous resistance to moving through a very thick fluid of water. If you're on the moon, you've got no fluid at all around you, obviously. You've got no atmosphere around you either. Therefore, it was logical to assume you would move fairly fast. So quite why they are all shown moving slowly, maybe it's to do with keeping balance, maybe it's to do with having to stop and there's no resistance to the body. There are various explanations for it, but main explanation for why they kept moving relatively slowly, and they appear to have a sort of bouncing motion, is to do with the way the film was actually shot and the sequence of the actual frame rate of the film itself.
Marcus, for those of us who remember using actual film and then going through an airport, if our film was sensitive enough, if it had a certain ASA or ISO, the speed of the film, you would hand it to the person at security so that it would go around the X-ray machine rather than through the X-ray machine, because that would fog your film. What about that? I mean, we have the Van Allen belts, of course. It's disputed whether Van Allen belts are lethal or not. But would even a little bit of radiation have caused a fog on those on the film taken on the moon?
The short answer is yes, of course it would. It's a very good point about the old style X-ray machines at airports. Yes, they were quite crude when they were first introduced. By the way, they were first introduced as a result of the D.B. Cooper affair from 1971, which is the only successful and unsolved hijacking in the United States. Searching of luggage was then introduced, and that was introduced by using X-ray machines, which, as I say, were fairly crude. So if you carried film, any photographer working in the 70s will remember that you had to put your camera and your film hand searched, i.e. you would pass it to the attendant at the security barrier. He would look at it in the normal way, security way, and not put it through the X-ray machine because of the danger of fogging of the film. Now, fogging is a technical term in terms of photographic film, and it basically implies that the film has reduced contrast, and it appears to be fogged, like you're trying to take an image in a thick fog. Now, fogging is created and caused on photographic film by radiation. And anybody who used photographic film back in the 60s, 70s will recall that the film had an expiry date, which seemed a bit odd because photographic film is not biological. So it can't really expire like a piece of meat can. So why would it have an expiry date? And that was purely because the manufacturers of the film, mainly Kodak in those days, Fuji, Ilford, Agfa, they knew perfectly well that if photographic film was kept around in your house for long enough, the background radiation, which occurs all the time, the background radiation would be such that the film would be damaged and it would become fogged. So the manufacturers would put an expiry date, usually about 10, 12, 15 years from the time it was actually manufactured, because radiation is cumulative. It builds up. If you've got a photographic film stuck in the back of a drawer and you suddenly find it sort of years after you bought it, and you think, oh, I'll stick that in the camera and take a few pictures, you may get a result back which is not what you're expecting. It could be fogged. So we know that radiation damages photographic film. We know that X-ray machines at airports would affect photographic film, especially high-speed film. As you say, that the higher ISO number, that the faster the film, i.e. the more sensitive the film, more sensitive
precisely
to light, and more sensitive to radiation. Because light is purely part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
Indeed. Marcus, pardon the interruption. I've got to take a time out here. We'll come back and pick up on this conversation. Questions and comments await as well. Here is Solomon Burke in a Van Morrison tune called Fast Train on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. This is Bob Dylan, and Things Have Changed from the film Wonder Boys, which was released back in May of 2000, and it garnered Robert Zimmerman the Academy Award for Best Original Song and the Golden Globe Award for Best Original Song. Not bad, Bob. Not bad at all. Sean Latasseur doing a yeoman's duty up at the website coasttocoastam.com, where he's posted a lot of tantalizing tidbits. If you'd like to find out how scientists are warning that global sea levels could continue to rise as much as 30 feet over the coming decades, you can check that out. That's a story by Unexplained Mysteries. And again, that's available at the website coasttocoastam.com. And let me just remind you, next time on Coast to Coast, that's tonight into Monday morning, in the first half, George Knapp will be joined by the Foundations of Mind Project founder, Sean O'Nualien, who asserts that the study of mind is the most important scientific venture for humanity. And that'll be followed by Professor James Secord, who discusses how the first half of the 19th century witnessed an extraordinary transformation across many fields and ways we can look toward the future, connecting the scientists, or the sciences rather. In the second half, Albert Rosales had many strange incidents as a child and developed an interest in UFOs and unusual events. After 40 years of extensive research, he's released a 10-plus book series on Tales of Strange Beings, and he'll share bizarre global reports of UFO occupants, including ultra-terrestrials, ETs, flying humanoids, and exotic humanoid hybrids. That's Sunday night into Monday morning, Coast to Coast AM with George Knapp. More of my conversation with Marcus Allen from Nexus Magazine and his contention that the lunar landings, all six missions, Apollo missions 11 through 17, were hoaxes. Your questions and comments as well. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate talk radio, AM 640. Marcus Allen on the line. A Nexus Magazine. Marcus, how can people subscribe to Nexus?
You just go onto our website, nexusmagazine.com, and check it out there. Nexus is Australian magazine, so that's where the website is. But if you go onto nexusmagazine.com, for a one-year subscription, $29.99 US dollars or $49.99 Canadian dollars, you get six issues of Nexus, and you get the six digital issues that accompany it. And those digital issues have the hyperlinks and clips that come with each article, which allow you to extend your research, because that is what Nexus is. It's the entry point that you would use to identify a particular area that you're interested in. You can then follow up. It could be a lifetime's work after that, which it has been for me on the moon landing controversy. But Nexus Magazine will cover many different areas. So check it out, nexusmagazine.com, and you're well on your way to finding out the truth behind the lies of the media.
All right. You mentioned the lunar landing controversy. And how do you respond to those who would say that by calling the lunar landing a hoax, we have 400,000 people that were employed by the Apollo program alone. We have, you know, the lives of people like Charles Bassett and Elliot Sea, who died during Gemini 9, and Roger Chaffee and Virgil Grissom, Mercury 4, and Apollo 1 astronauts who died in a horrible fire aboard the spacecraft cabin. We had pilots, you know, these T-38s that crashed, and the X-15, Michael J. Adams, back in 1967. All of these people who gave their lives for the space mission, and that by attempting by suggesting that the lunar landing was a hoax, you are tainting their memory as well as the work of hundreds of thousands of people. How do you respond to that?
It's a very good point, and thank you for raising it. In respect to the 400,000 people who worked on the Apollo program, those 400,000 people worked for the various contractors that were contracted to NASA to supply the rockets, the rovers, the command centers, all the building, all the work that was done. And of those 400,000 people, 99.99% had no knowledge of any underhand activity. They were doing the very best job they could. They were doing what they were employed to do, whether they were secretaries or gardeners or security guards at the big companies, whether they were the managing directors, the engineers, the scientists who worked on the programs. These people would have had no knowledge whatsoever of any underhand activity, of any misdirection. there would probably be at the most 30 to 40 people who would have had a knowledge of some part of a misdirection that was going on. Obviously, the astronauts themselves would have known. A few of the people who were employed at the head of NASA would have known. Thomas Paine, for instance, who was the administrator of NASA in the late 1960s, he would have known, but he honorably resigned just after Apollo 8, when he was required, his resignation was required by Lyndon Johnson. There were a few people who would have known about it, but even they probably wouldn't have known the full picture, because it's what's called compartmentalization. You know enough to do your job. You don't need to know what the guy down the road is doing, and you certainly wouldn't know what the guy in the company on the other side of America would know. So the people in Boeing in Washington State would have had very little knowledge of what the people in Houston were doing. They would have had equally little knowledge of what the people in California were doing, or Virginia, or Florida were doing. It was spread right across America. Now, as regards the astronauts who died during the Apollo program, you mentioned Gus Grissom, Virgil Grissom, Chaffee and White, who died rather horribly in Apollo 1, the fire of Apollo 1. You would have thought that some scientist somewhere would have known that a pure oxygen environment, which is what they were sitting in, was an extremely lethal concoction, and that any spark would have set an oxygen fire off. You would have thought they would have known that. So there's a certain amount of blame that should be attached to the people who set up that particular test. Gus Grissom, by the way, he was supposed to be the first man on the moon. It wasn't supposed to be Neil Armstrong. It was actually Gus Grissom. He was one of the most respected astronauts of the time. He was the one who was going to be on the lunar surface for the first time. So he would have known a great deal about what was going on. So why did Gus Grissom hang a lemon on his spacecraft a couple of years before they actually landed on the moon, if not to say, look, guys, you know, this is a complete farce. We can't, as he said at the time, we can't even talk between two buildings here in Florida, let alone between Earth and the moon. We've got to get our act together a bit. Unfortunately, he died. Whether it was deliberate or not is debatable. Gus Grissom's son, Scott Grissom, did get access to the capsule in which his father died, and discovered that there were some anomalies in the wiring circuits. He was the one who claimed that his father had been murdered. Whether that's correct or not, I don't know. It could well have been just a mistake. There were other people. You mentioned some of the early astronauts who were killed in aircraft crashes. These things happen. Now, when one is saying that the Apollo moon landings are fabricated, and the Apollo record has been altered and is seriously flawed, this is not to dispute the dedication of the 400,000 people who worked on the program. They were doing the best job they could. One could equally well say that the 58,000 U.S. servicemen who died in Vietnam do not have a proper memorial. 58,000 American servicemen died in Vietnam. Several million Vietnamese died. Where is the apology from the diplomats and the politicians who determined that that would happen? This is a far greater number than the people who dedicated their lives to the development of science and the development of space, who were working in extreme environments. They knew perfectly well that there was likely to be deaths. When you're working at that level, these things happen. They would be willing to accept the dangers. They would hope to mitigate the risks, certainly. But if the dangers were such that they were to sacrifice their life, they would say, I did it because I wanted to do it. If their death is the result of a deliberate action by somebody else, that is quite properly called murder. Whether murder occurred hasn't been proven yet. It can be suspected, but it cannot be proven because the information is just not available to say it. So when I say that the Apollo missions are fabricated, this is not to dispute the people who contributed to it. You could say that anybody who dies in a motor accident, does the manufacturer of the car in which they died have a responsibility for that person's death? To an extent, they do, if the fault lies in the design and the construction of the car.
All right.
There are certain cars which were death traps in themselves.
Okay, I want to move back to the calls, if we can. Let's say hello to Jeff in Adamsville, Tennessee, calling in on the wild card line. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Jeff. We're listening.
Yes, and I listened to on Somewhere in Time with Art Bell. And in 2009, they said a survey on Great Britain that said 25% of the population or something thought it was a fake. And today's time, what would the U.S. or Great Britain's survey be today? And also, I got another question. Do you think the CIA or government was involved in the astronauts being killed?
All right. So thank you for the call, Jeff. The first question, I mentioned actually off the top that in a 2009 poll, it said 25% of people in the U.K. believe some part of the narrative, the Apollo lunar narrative, was fabricated. I think Jeff was asking, you know, what percentage do you think today believe that? Is that number growing? Is it diminishing?
It would appear that the number is growing. It's quite extraordinary the number of people who are aware of the anomalies and the inconsistencies and the unexplained details within the Apollo record. As I mentioned earlier, I've been looking at this for over 20 years now. There are many people around the world, and if they've heard me speaking, several people have heard my previous broadcast on Coast to Coast, which was actually 12 years ago. It was a remarkable event, that, because that produced a very interesting contribution from Jack White, who was listening to the program. He lived in Texas, and he contributed a considerable amount of research that he had done, which is now available on a website called Aulis, that's A-U-L-I-S, aulis.com, where the photographic record has been deconstructed in amazing detail. Jack was a photo analyst. He heard the program, and he contacted me through Nexus magazine and contributed his work. There are many other people around the world who've also researched this in their own particular way. I'm in contact with many interesting researchers, specifically Scott up in Canada, near Toronto, who's been looking at the photographs, looking at the images, and he contributes a considerable amount of really valuable information towards this research. There are people in France, there are people in New Zealand, there are people in Australia, people right across Europe, people in Russia are now looking at it in detail. And that is a really interesting development. So there are people working away quietly at their computers, examining it. Now the record is available online. And they're finding increasing numbers of anomalies. I've given many hundreds of presentations on the subject. I've done a lot of broadcasts on the subject.
I wanted to ask you about that because you walked into the lion's den. You were invited by the British Interplanetary Society, which has included members like Arthur C. Clarke. And these are, I would presume, astrophysicists and astronomers and engineers and people involved in various space sciences. And you were invited to tell them, to prove to them that the lunar landings were a hoax. How did that invitation come about? How was it received?
It was a fascinating experience, that one. The invitation came about as a result of their presentations committee at the British Interplanetary Society, which incidentally was founded in 1933 in Liverpool in north of England. It's now based in London, and it is the world's leading society of its type. It's highly respected. Many of the astronauts are honorary members. the astronomical community in the UK and around the world are members. Spaceflight Magazine is their publication, very interesting. They were planning a series of talks. This was about 4 years ago. And one of the talks was suggested that they might like to hear from somebody who could prove that the Apollo missions didn't happen. Now, the editor of Spaceflight Magazine is David Baker, who worked for NASA in Florida and in Virginia for about 20 years. Though he's British, he was working there, and he is knowledgeable about the subject. He's written one of the definitive books on the subject of spaceflight. So these are people who are knowledgeable about the subject, and they thought, well, we'll get this Marcus Allen chap in, and we'll just hear what he has to say, and we'll just prove him wrong.
Were you fearful at all that maybe you were wrong and they might point something out that you'd overlooked?
Well, secretly, I would like to be wrong, because I would like the Apollo program, which is one of the defining events of the 20th century, to have happened the way we were shown it happened. Looking at the evidence, this is something I cannot reach a conclusion on. I cannot conclude that they did what they said they did. So there I am, invited to present my case to the British Interplanetary Society, and obviously they announce it on their website and in their magazine. And then the sky fell in. Everybody decided that this was a most ridiculous idea. How could such an esteemed society possibly invite a hoax believer, because that's what people like me are referred to as, hoax believers, HBs, how could somebody be invited just to address this society, because that would give credence to the fact that maybe I was right. So, as I say, the sky fell in, the internet went a bit into meltdown. How dare they invite somebody like this? But the society, to its credit, held firm and said, no, we have invited this speaker, and we will intend to hear what he has to say. We will change the format slightly, they said. We will not have him just speaking. We will have him refuted. So it became a debate rather than a presentation. I had 20 minutes in which to make my case. Then one of the members of the society, who is well known for promoting the wonderfulness of NASA and the amazingness of Apollo, to refute me, because he would obviously be fully familiar with all the points I was making and could tear them apart and just say that this is the reason why Marcus Allen is wrong. So I did my 20 minutes, and then the other gentleman did his 20 minutes, and then we had a question and answer session for the members who were attending. And that lasted about an hour, which is twice the time it was actually supposed to last, because of...
Did you change any minds, Marcus? Did you change any minds?
Whether I changed minds or not, I'm not certain. There were one or two people who came up to me after the event and said, I think you got some interesting points there. So they were prepared to look at it. But the main point was that the points I made were not refuted, because the other speaker basically just did his standard presentation on the wonderfulness of NASA.
All right, I've got to jump in here, Marcus, and take a time out. Here's Dusty Springfield taking us into the break with Nowhere to Run on Coast to Coast AM.